Wait, so you were there the whole time that Rudy was filming?
I worked on it, yeah. Yeah, I worked on set as a PA, and then at night I would project the dailies at a Marriott hotel around the corner from campus. I mean, I'll tell you a quick little anecdote of something I learned when I was working on it. I was projecting dailies, and there's the scene where Sean Astin gets accepted to the University of Notre Dame, and in take one, he like reads the acceptance letter, and it's kind of a very subtle performance, and I thought it was pretty good. And then take two, his performance grows bigger, and his eyes start to well up with tears. And then take three, four. By take seven, like he's like blabbering like a baby. And I say to my friend, God, this director doesn't know what he's doing. And Sean Astin's performance was great on take one. He must be telling him the stupidest direction ever, because I don't know why he would want this direction to go in this, the performance to go in this direction. It's so stupid. And then the editor like ran in the back projection booth and said, you idiot. That actor is giving a bracketed performance, so I know I at any point in the movie I can choose where we want to be emotionally, and you don't know what the hell you're talking about, so you just shut your mouth, you'll never work in this town again. So I learned a little bit. I learned how much I did know working on Rudy and how far I had to go. And that was part of my decision to go to NYU grad film school.
That's Michael Canzoniero on this week's episode of Vibe Check with Mopi. Born and raised in Shoreham, New York, Michael Canzoniero is a graduate of the University of Notre Dame and the NYU Graduate Film Program. His explosive short film, Hyper, played in the centerpiece of the 2002 New York Film Festival, where it opened for P.T. Anderson's Punch Drunk Love. In 2009, his feature, The Marconi Bros, premiered at the SXSW Film Festival. In 2011, Canzoniero directed the award-winning documentary Shelter Island, and recently completed his latest project, Making the Day, this year in 2020. He is the owner of MCM Creative, which is a Manhattan-based production and post-production facility in Chelsea. They produce television, documentary, indie features, and commercials. This is my podcast with him. Hello, Michael. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Like I mentioned before we started, the larger goal of this podcast is to interact with you, learn about your journey, the challenges you face, and interesting breakthroughs you could probably share with us. But firstly, I'm most curious about where your journey and interest in filmmaking started and how you were like as a student in like high school.
Sure. I mean, I'm the generation that actually saw Star Wars in the movie theater for the first time. So I'm that old. And yeah. I think one of my earliest memories is sitting in a drive-in movie theater watching Star Wars, and I remember thinking to myself, I wish this would never end. sitting in that between my parents in the front seat, just wishing, and somewhere in the middle of that movie that I just would never, this movie would just never end. I was having so much fun, and by the time I was probably in the third grade, I was pretty much sure that making movies like Star Wars was all I wanted to do in life. And wow. I became an avid Star Wars figure collector, and I would make Super 8 movies with my cousin and brother with Star Wars figures. And we basically recreated Star Wars as a Super 8 movie. Wow. We were that obsessed with it. And my brother, Chris, and my cousin, Marco, formed with me, Mike, the company MCM, which I still go by today as my production mm-hmm. company name, MCM, MCM Creative in New York. Yeah. Although my brother now is a pediatrician, and my cousin actually stayed in the business and is a documentary filmmaker.
Oh, awesome. So have you guys made movies together multiple times?
Well, my cousin, Marco, and I, yes, we worked together on tons of film in high school, and then in graduate school, my thesis film, Marco and I co-wrote and co-directed. That was called Pichadu, and that mm-hmm. won the Princess Grace Award for best graduate level film in the nation and a bunch of other awards. So that did really well for us. And then we went on and did that short Hyper together that we played at the New York Film Festival, and that also got distribution, which is pretty rare for a short. And then we co-wrote and co-directed the Marconi Brothers, which was our first feature in 2006 that we played at South by Southwest. And then after that, we kind of went our separate ways, not in a totally friendly way, but we just realized we were very, very similar. And in a way, the best person to collaborate with sometimes isn't someone that's similar to you, but someone that complements mm-hmm. you. I think Marco and I both realized that we were a little redundant sometimes on set, but we had very mm-hmm. similar skill sets. And we ended up working separately at that point on as filmmakers.
Oh, that's super cool. I like how the brothers got into the industry together and just been together.
It's always, in the beginning, it's great to have a collaborative partner, especially if you can be a family member, something you really trust that you know isn't going to stab you in the back.
Right.
But it's a lonely, long road, the filmmaking world. And if you can have someone go on that journey with you, it does make it easier, because it is a very long, grueling journey. And to have someone be on that with you really helps.
Yeah, definitely. One of the major reasons I was interested in reaching out to you is, apart from my own interest in film, you're also a Notre Dame alum. So how was your transition to going from high school, and why ND? What's your ND story?
Notre Dame is won the national championship the year I applied. So they were on everyone's radar that year for sure. But also my father was a very Catholic man. He was actually in the priesthood before he met my mother. So he probably made a deal with God that he would have to send all his kids to Notre Dame if he left the priesthood. And he ended up doing that. All four of us went there. And of course, when I visited the campus, I fell in love with Notre Dame, and I met people like Ted Mandel that were just great teachers here in film, and I felt like I could get a good film education at Notre Dame, and I did. I would say that in some ways, being at Notre Dame, I was a little bit of getting to be a big fish in a smaller pond, where if I'd gone to NYU or USC for undergrad with 700 other film students, I might not have had all the opportunities I had at Notre Dame. Notre Dame basically gave me the keys to the castle when I was there. I got to grab cameras and shoot films whenever I kind of felt like it. And those were some glory days for me in my film career, just getting to make films all the time with my classmates and roommates and people like that. So we had a great experience. The other end of that, and we just released the documentary yesterday for first-time fans, is the story of how I worked on the movie Rudy when I was a student at Notre Dame. And that was my first real experience in the real Hollywood film world. I got to see every frame of footage that was shot for the movie Rudy, and I projected it on a 35mm projector. So that another great experience that came out of Notre Dame.
Wait, so you were there the whole time that Rudy was filming?
I worked on it, yeah. Yeah, I worked on set as a PA, and then at night I would project the dailies at a Marriott hotel around the corner from campus, and they turned one of their conference rooms into a 30-seat theater. And I would thread up this big 35mm projector and run the dailies for them.
So was it an instant hit when it came out?
No, I mean, it was okay, but it's become a cult classic for sure. It wasn't like, you know, the hugest movie ever, but it has had legs because it's such an inspiring story.
It definitely aged well on campus, because they play the movie in the stadium on like the first week when the new class enters. So that's when I first watched it last year when I was a freshman. And then, yeah, it was like a few thousand kids showed up and everyone's going, Rudy, Rudy. It was an electric atmosphere.
It's a great movie. I'll tell you a quick little anecdote of something I learned when I was working on it. I was projecting dailies, and there's the scene where Sean Astin gets accepted to the University of Notre Dame, and in take one, he like reads the acceptance letter, and it's kind of a very subtle performance, and I thought it was pretty good. And then take two, his performance grows bigger and his eyes start to well up with tears. And then take three, four, by take seven, like he's like blabbering like a baby. And I say to my friend, God, this director doesn't know what he's doing. And Sean Astin's performance was great on take one. He must be telling him the stupidest direction ever, because I don't know why he would want this direction to go in this, the performance to go in this direction. So stupid. And then the editor like ran in the back projection booth and said, you idiot. That actor is giving a bracketed performance. So I know at any point in the movie, I can choose where we want to be emotionally. And you don't know what the hell you're talking about. So you just shut your mouth. You'll never work in this town again. So I learned a little bit. I learned how much I did know working on Rudy and how far I had to go. And that was part of my decision to go to NYU grad film school, realizing and working on Rudy, oh my God, you know, I've been making up the rules of filmmaking and how to do this on my own since the beginning. And I really needed a place like NYU to take my directing game up to another level, which it did.
All right. So as a college student, deciding what you wanted to do as a career, I mean, you knew you were interested in film. Did you know which direction you wanted to go, and what pushed you to do grad school?
Well, I always saw myself as a writer-director. I definitely, idolized the auteur filmmakers like Kubrick and Fellini. So I always assumed I would be in that role, although I had a huge interest in cinematography. And I never had an interest in acting, actually, but I did like working with actors. But I did study in the Notre Dame London program, which was a great, really great experience. I highly recommend.
I was actually planning to go in the fall, but I think it's going to be canceled in the next two weeks, which man. I'm very disappointed about.
It was my favorite experience at Notre Dame with that semester in London. It was so incredible, and it just opened my eyes culturally to, you know, so many great works of history, whether it be art or ballet, opera, theater. I mean, it was just a total eye opener for me, and I still value that semester as one of the greatest educational experiences of my life.
I'm so sad now because some of my closest friends also got into the program, and we were all super excited to go. And I was going to only take FTT classes when I went there, and one business class. And I thought it would just be a whole semester of just trying cool film stuff.
It's so great! Yeah, I hope you get to go. It was an amazing experience. The culture of London is just amazing to just dive into. And the teachers over there were fantastic.
Right. So how was grad school itself for you? Because how many years were you there? 4 or 5 years?
Grad school for me began right out of college. So I started in the fall of 93, and I was finishing up my thesis film around 98. So it almost took me 5 years to get through it with the thesis. But I think class-wise, it was 3 years at NYU. And there was only 50 students a year accepted into the NYU grad film program. So it was super competitive to get in. But I got a really nice reference letter from a professor at Notre Dame named Jill Godmill, who was there for many years, and she wrote a really great recommendation. And I'm 90% sure that's what got me in, was because Jill was a very respected filmmaker in New York, and I knew of her. So her recommendation really helped. It's a great experience. NYU is an incredible film school. I can't speak to it in the last 10 years because I haven't been back there a lot. But when I was there, I mean, first of all, out of the 50 students in that program, 10 of them are legitimate all-stars in Hollywood right now, big time directors and producers that are like, so, you know, if one out of five people in your group became Hollywood players, that's a pretty amazing, and I don't count myself in that group. I mean, I'm on that second tier of people that are still in the business making films, and there's probably another 10 or 15 of us that are still made a career out of it, which is just unbelievable odds when you think about how hard it is to make it in the film world as a filmmaker to get to make movies. But I was in classes with, forget about some great teachers like Spike Lee that were there teaching, but I was in classes with people like John Hamburg, who went on to create I Love You Man and Meet the Parents and Along Came Polly and so many great comedies. And then Brett Morgan, an Oscar nominated documentary filmmaker, considered one of the greatest doc filmmakers out there right now. Malcolm Lee, who was Spike's cousin, has gone on to make a dozen Hollywood features and is considered one of the most commercially successful African-American filmmakers on the planet right now. Steve McQueen, who is an amazing filmmaker that did 12 Years a Slave and Hunger. There's so many more. Morgan J. Freeman, who won Sundance. I mean, it was like, these are the guys I hung out with. It was like a who's who of amazing filmmakers. So that is the connections and friends that I made at NYU were worth the price of tuition. Not to mention you'd have Scorsese come by and teach a master class, or Ferrara, Jim Jarmusch, and all these great filmmakers. Yeah.
Wow. So what do you think the characteristics among all of you led so many of you to be very successful in this very competitive industry?
Well, I don't consider myself very successful. I have been grinding in this industry for a long time. I think I think if there's anything that would speak to that is just I'm very persistent and never gave up more than talent. It's like, I think that's the number one quality you need, is to be able to survive the long, grueling road that is filmmaking, especially indie filmmaking. If you don't go out to Hollywood and try and work in that industry, which means you want to be basically more of an auteur director doing your own thing with that, not just whatever the studios are handing you. That the road of an indie filmmaker is a lot harder today than it was even in the 90s, when you had people like Spike Lee and Jim Jarmusch and all these great indie directors kind of getting to make little indies back then and make money with them. The situation is very different now. So I, yeah, the persistence is one. I mean, a passion. I never show up on a film shoot and I'm not happy to be there. I've always enjoyed the process. I've always enjoyed the technical side of it. And I've always enjoyed the creative side of it. I love working with other artists. I'm definitely a someone that has learned to kind of like go with the flow a little bit more in terms of mm-hmm. the process and be making the most of what I have rather than kind of living the future and wishing I could have more. I've changed my style of writing to accommodate the idea that I'm not going to have $100 million to make the film, but I still believe great films can be made for next to nothing. You know, mm-hmm. tell the right story and do it in the right way.
Right. So talking about that, like making the day, how was that experience? Cause it was made in a short span of time, right?
No, a long span of time.
A long span of time. No.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of.
No,
what
it was made for a low budget. It was made
oh,
for a
low budget. Okay, yeah. That's what I switched
yeah,
up.
Yeah. No, I made the movie for, I'm not going to say, but basically peanuts. I can't say the amount because I'm trying to sell the film right now. I want to keep that information private. Mm-hmm. But so what I did is I realized how difficult it was to try to get doors open in Hollywood. It's a very much a who you know industry and requires basically all of your energy going into networking and get it and to, in order to like get out there and get greenlit in Hollywood. You need to have one Sundance or something where you're this golden child, or you have an uncle that owns a studio or a father that's a movie star or a mother that, or an aunt that can get you these breaks. But if you were like me and you don't have all those connections, mm-hmm. The doors to that castle don't open up easily. And it's not, I mean, I don't hope this doesn't sound bitter, but I don't think it's completely talent-based. I think there's a lot of it is luck and being in the right place at the right time and who you know and all those things. I just got really frustrated with all of my years sending my first script specifically to Hollywood studios, trying to get them to greenlight. Just in hindsight, it's comical that I wasted like 4 years cold submitting screenplays to studios and producers thinking this is going to get picked up. I mean, it could have, but I also could have won Lotto in that time. I mean, so now the attitude was, look, I am someone that needs to make movies in order to breathe. Like that is part of my DNA now. I have to be working on a movie at all times. That's just what I want to do with my life. Mm-hmm. And so about 10 years ago, I slowly began to build up a production company. And I also have a wife and kids now, so I have to make some money. Okay. And it's one thing to be a starving artist. When I was a student at NYU, I was so broke, but it didn't matter because I was only supporting myself. And I was 100% just dedicated to the craft and to the study of film and filmmaking. But as you get married, have kids and a family, more responsibilities, that doesn't fly. So you have to figure out how to make a living. And for many years, I made a living as a cameraman because that's the work that's always available or was always available in New York. But eventually I decided, you know, if I buy, even in that short film Hyper was made with my own equipment, I realized pretty early on that, look, if I own enough gear, the cost of making a film doesn't have to be even $1 million. Mm-hmm. Because if I can bring to the production all the lighting, all the cameras, all the sound. And then on top of that, now with having in my own production company, I have a lot of crew that I know very well, that I know how good they are. We can go out and on a weekend do a shoot and it costs me next to nothing. Because I have all the gear. So I started that approach. And so I think, yeah, about 10 years ago, I started to make indie films that were either self-financed or financed for very little money. And then I was able to greenlight myself. And that's been the most rewarding part of that decade. Mm-hmm. Is I didn't spend 1 hour chasing down some Hollywood thing that, you know, and that's, eventually, if it doesn't fit into the formula of what they're looking for, is probably a wasted effort. So I put all my energy into actually making films, whether they're low budget or not, doesn't matter to me. I'm actually doing creative stuff rather than just, you know, chasing that Hollywood money that always seemed to me like a long shot for someone like myself, whose sensibilities don't lend themselves to Hollywood. I mean, it's one thing if you have a Steven Spielberg kind of brain and your dream movie is something that the rest of the world is going to freak out over because it's so commercial and it's so happy and it's so, but the kind of movies that I love and the kind of movies I think about tend to be darker and less commercial and more, I don't know, deep and more subtle and not the typical Hollywood product. So aside from all the successful good work that's happening on like Netflix and streaming services and series form right now, the film world is basically dominated by these big tentpole action movies and very broad comedies and things like that that are not my sensibility. If they were, maybe I would have gone out to California, but it's not. I mean, my favorite filmmaker is like Fellini, Tarkovsky, and Kubrick. So, you know, those kind of movies just don't get made anymore. So I figured out a way to basically continue to make films on my own.
That's awesome. I know you mentioned you did being work as a cameraman, but right out of NYU, what opportunity did you jump on the moment you graduated?
You know, at NYU, I got offered work on some indie films and some music videos as a PA. That's the lowest rung of a production, right? So even with that great film school degree, even though I finished in the top three of my class at NYU, it wasn't like Hollywood came knocking me like, here's a script for you to direct. That doesn't happen at all. Anyone that thinks you're going to get out of film school and be handed movies to direct, you're on drugs. There were filmmakers out of NYU that had family money and were able to greenlight their own $1.5 million feature the day they graduated from NYU. That wasn't my situation. I needed to raise about $700,000 for my first feature. That's what movies were costing back then. And that took me about 7 years to raise that money. So what did I do? I had a cinematography teacher at NYU that had an old assistant cameraman that had become a wedding videographer. And he said, you know, you could work for this guy as his assistant on weddings. So that was my first job after NYU, was working for a crazy wedding videographer named Maurice Brown. He had been the AC on Jaws and Kojak and all these great movies, but he never made it as a DP. And he wanted to be the boss, so he became a wedding videographer. That way he could be the boss.
Whatever it takes.
And he used to treat the weddings like they were movie sets. He would call like action and stuff like that. He was a total like cheeseball, but he'd be like, I bring the Hollywood touch to their wedding. You know, he would show pictures of him working on Billy Joel music videos to his clients and impress them. Look, I was the AC on Jaws, the TV show Kojak. Anyway, he was a lunatic, but my cousin Marco and I were working with him together, and that became the inspiration for our first script after film school, was work the story of us working for that lunatic. And so in the movie, the character that John Polito plays, the movie's called The Wedding Bros, and it was at South by Southwest in 2008. And the character that John Polito plays is based on Maurice Brown, very, very literally. That's exactly what he's going to say. So if you watch it, it's on Amazon. If you watch it, you'll see exactly what my early career was all about.
I definitely have to check this out. That is so funny.
Yeah.
So wait, how hard, you said it took almost 7 years to raise money. So how challenging was it, and what kind of conversations do you have to like pitch your idea and say, I need this kind of money to make this happen?
So I graduate NYU, let's say in 98. And now from 99 to about 2006, I am writing a couple of scripts with my cousin, most of them unproducible at the budgets that I would ever get. But the one that we thought we could make was called The Marconi Brothers. We wrote 17 drafts of it, 17 drafts of it. And we knocked on every studio door. We went after every producer. The closest we ever came was a director named Michael Corrente, who had some success in the indie world, really liked the script. He had just done Outside Providence with Alec Baldwin. He was in the Harvey Weinstein world. Harvey was greenlighting his movies. And Michael seemed interested in producing our movie and really liked it. But every time we'd meet with him, he'd give us notes on the script. And then we'd go away, and for two more months, we'd take all his notes into account and then bring it back to him. And then he'd have more notes and more notes. And finally, this went on for about a year and a half, and we just finally gave up trying to make him happy and realized, you know what, we're happy with the script. We just got to make it. So we let go. That was our last grasp at trying to get Hollywood money. I mean, there's a lesson in that, I guess. It's like, if you're happy with the script yourself, you should somehow make that movie, because you're never going to make everyone else happy. I mean, I feel like we wasted a good year and a half there taking the script in the direction we didn't necessarily want it to go, to try and please some studio.
Okay.
And, It was a little futile, so can't get that time back, but it was a lesson I learned. Ever since then, I've really never rewritten for anybody else.
So would you say that was like one of the major breakthrough points in your career? Just choosing to be
independent? Making that film?
Yeah, making the film, or even taking the decision to be like, screw chasing all these guys. I'm going to
I mean, again, if I had had a mentor, I think the mentor would have so told me after draft number six, hey, this is good enough. Make this film and you'll learn a lot in your first feature. And then your second film will be better because the first films are very difficult. You're learning everything for the first time. There's no short film in the world can prepare you for what it's like to make a feature in 25 days. It's like going to war. Unless you've been in war, you have no idea. You have no idea what 25 days of shooting can do to your body and your brain, and how beat up you can get, and how you have to be thinking about this enormous picture the whole time.
So does it take up like every waking moment you're up to something? You're always thinking about what you can do to make this movie better, or like changing everything about it? Like,
well, making a feature film doesn't begin on day one of shooting. There's about a 2-month period before the shoot where you're working every single day, 12 hours to 15 hours a day, locking locations, casting, figuring out production design, figuring out your crew, figuring out your shooting schedule. So it's not like it's just the 25 days of shooting. It's the 2 months prior to that where you're already burning yourself out. And you're trying to figure out how to do all of this stuff when you really don't have the money to do it right. I mean, there's a whole other world of filmmaking where their budget is whatever it needs to be. But indie filmmaking, that's not the case. You have a fixed amount of money. And in that case of that film, I think we went into production with maybe $500,000. The finished budget ended up being more like $657,000. But yeah, for $500,000, you start killing your darlings right away. And it's just a very depressing, horrible experience. Yeah. I probably enjoyed making that first feature less than any other filmmaking experience in my life. And the one that I just made, I enjoyed more than any other one in my life. So I've changed my approach to filmmaking. Well, I don't ever put myself in a situation where you've got 30 minutes to do this whole scene. Go ahead, go for it. Like that's what my first feature felt like. That we were running out of time and we were not getting to do things as good as we thought we could do them just because we didn't have the time in our schedule to do it. So the way I making the day, I would say to the actors, we've got all day to just do this little 2-page scene. Let's play with it. Let's have fun with it. Let's explore it. Let's workshop it. So I went from making films the traditional way, which is like you have a shooting schedule and you have to get 10 pages of script done, or I think we had to do about 6 pages of script per day, to another. And then with a big machine behind you and all these, you know, 50 people on set and moving every setup takes you an hour to just change a location. I just changed my whole approach based on now my knowledge of filmmaking of like, I go with a much smaller crew. I give myself much more time to be on set. And I spend a lot more focus as a director, not thinking about the lighting, the production, the sound, the location, the people that I'm working with. And I focus all of my energy on the scene working with the actors in conjunction with the camera. But my focus is much more on point now because I've learned to put myself in situations where when I'm on set, I can do that instead of worrying about, oh my God, I've got 30 minutes to get the scene done. Yeah. Or they're going to turn the lights off in the building. Rent it, you know.
Wow. So were you guys able to flip a profit on the movie, the Marconi one?
No,
the Marconi Bros? No.
No. And that's a whole nother nightmare no one tells you about in film school. You beg, borrow, and steal, you know, $500,000 or more from friends and family and from investors that are doctors and dentists and lawyers that think they're going to get rich on your movie. And then you spend the next 3 years of your life getting angry emails going, I can't believe this movie didn't sell in Africa. Where's the receipt for that? And like, when they actually, and then you do say, I mean, I sold the movie to Universal. And they gave us a $50,000 advance, which is the only money we ever saw. Everything else and the movie sold in over 30 countries. And every time they would sell the movie, they would claim that the expenses of marketing the movie outstripped what they made in the sale, which was bullshit, but that's how the industry works.
Ah, that's
really depressing.
That was your first feature, It must have been a challenging time.
It took the wind out of my sails completely. It was a completely depressing experience at the end of the day. It was not in any way how I expected my career to go. I thought we were going to make that film, win Sundance, and I'd be off in Hollywood doing much bigger movies and having the Coen brothers career. So that didn't happen. And not for a lack of trying, honestly.
Right.
We worked our asses off. And we made a pretty good movie, too. It's just, it's a very tough business. So then I hunkered down, and that's when I started, you know, developing my own business. And I still have a very rewarding career outside of traditional feature filmmaking. I'm a I've made documentaries. I've directed TV shows. I've been around the world. I've been to Ethiopia, Papua New Guinea, Calcutta, India. I just went to Japan, China, and Korea in the past year. I mean, I've gotten to see everywhere from backstage at a Bruce Springsteen concert to inside of a brain surgery room to, you know, I have had such a rich experience just being in production for 20 years. I can't even tell you. There's almost nowhere that I haven't been able to get inside. It's the White House, and I was shooting Nancy Pelosi 6 months ago, and during the, I mean, like, I've had a fascinating, great career. I have no regrets. It's been such a rich experience, but the passion is still for making the indie films, but the whole process of getting there, because I stayed in the industry, has been fascinating.
That's incredible. I think it's super cool when people get to travel and do their work simultaneously and enjoy that. I think that is definitely very rewarding. Mm-hmm. India? I'm actually from India. I'm from Bangalore, which is way south. I hope India was a good time.
It was great. I took my daughter on the first time I went there, and she did a whole photo journalistic experience on that trip, which was really a great opportunity for us to bond together. And we loved Calcutta. I just got an email from my driver that this is now going back 5 years. We're still good friends. The guy that was my driver when I was in Calcutta, and we've been stayed in touch ever since then. I love the guy. He took us to his family farm and just north of Calcutta, and like we just became lifelong friends. So, yeah, travel is one of the greatest things you can do in life for sure. And people that have traveled, I just feel like have a different perspective that, you know, you wouldn't have these Trump supporters being having so much hatred of the other and the foreigner if they had traveled more. But most of those people that are supporting those kind of policies have never left their hometown. Mm-hmm. They think New York is the other side of the planet.
I was super curious about you founding like MCM on how that process was and the biggest challenges you encountered when like trying to put this together.
Well, yeah. So that's a whole other part of my brain is the business side of it. And that dominates a lot of my days recently, you know, in the last few years, for sure, as we've grown this business from a couple people up to almost 12 employees now and a big piece of real estate in Chelsea with a stage and a podcast room and color rooms and sound mix suites and lighting trucks. So I don't know how I did it out of necessity might be the best answer that I've learned to become a businessman out of necessity. But here's two or three bits of advice I'd say about business. One is the film industry in general is a lot smaller than you think. In other words, your reputation will get out there. So if you're a hardworking guy and you do good work and you're a pleasure to be around, your people will continue to refer you and your business will grow. If you have the opposite of any of those things going on, your negative reputation will get out there and you'll find it very hard to make a career, because everybody, first and foremost, they make a decision whether to hire someone based on some word of mouth knowledge they have of people, much more than you would ever get by posting good Instagram photos. Or, you know, I kind of think all that social media stuff does not end up in the same results as, hey, I went out, I did a job, the executive producer saw how good I was, and he referred me for his next job, or he referred a friend for me to work on the next job. So reputation, and you just really have to have a positive attitude when you are working, that people want to be around you and continue to work with you. And then you work with integrity. You know, I've always tried to treat others as I would want to be treated myself. And that includes, so if I'm playing a job, just as a micro example, and there was a question of whether there was some overtime or not, I always err on the side of what I would, as a producer, would have expected, not what I think I can get away with as the vendor. So there's a lot of ethics that comes into being a good businessman and knowing there are no shortcuts. Like, you really have to, you have to work for your reputation and earn it. No one is, everyone out there is looking for people that are solid, honest, hardworking, and talented. And if you can become that, you'll get work. And if you're trying to take a shortcut, you won't.
Right. So how long has the production company existed till now?
Technically, we incorporated in 96. But really, that was Marco and I. But we really started to flourish as a company that had other employees and stuff only in the last 7 or 8 years.
So do you find yourself doing like a lot of the business side too now, like actively having to balance both the sides of the company to ensure you're like, well, you're making
the
money?
The business was so successful that I was able to finance the Making the Day film out of my own pocket. So
that's awesome.
That was the goal of the business. It was to have the tools, have the staff, and also have the money to make an indie film myself. And now, I mean, I don't know how many other people can say they can green light their own films, but I can now. And that's amazing to me. Because I used to get so frustrated, I'd be writing a script going, I don't know if this will ever get made. So it's that would be almost the voice in my head as I was writing was a fear that it wouldn't get to make the movie. So now that I've alleviated that, when I'm writing, I know I'm going to make this. And that really inspires me to write more because there's a chance that I can write. And I also am writing to things I know I can get, whether that's cast or locations or production value.
What's a bigger challenge in running a production company? Like things
my
that
my father's a psychologist, and he taught me a lot about psychology. And I definitely recommend that you study some psychology because as the boss of a company, a lot of what you're doing is managing the personalities of the people that are working for you. And you got to understand the way the human brain works and the things that people that are going to work for you are going to want and need. And it doesn't come down to dollars and cents. Often it comes down to whether you praise them, whether you are taking credit for things you shouldn't be taking credit for and depriving them of their own ego, boost on a job. Getting different types of personalities to work together. So you have somebody that is really very buttoned up and then somebody that's very loosey-goosey and knowing, hey, I might not want to send these two out in the same shoot together, knowing this client is going to work. So there's a lot of psychological, like, kind of reading the room that has to happen in business and running a company. And you got to know who's going to make for a good, staff member and who's going to be someone that's actually going to be a negative on your company side. So a lot of that psychology.
Was that something you were able to learn as you went on, or how did you gain those skills?
Well, I studied psychology classes at Notre Dame, and I mean, my father, again, as a psychologist, was always sharing his insights into it, but I mean, I would definitely recommend people study psychology and sociology and things like that, philosophy. Those all become really valuable tools for you as an owner of a business to understand that. I mean, also, I wish I understood more about business. I wish I understood more about marketing, but I've found some people that are better at that than inside the company at this point.
Awesome. Just a last few questions on more general stuff. How are you holding up during this whole virus situation?
Well, I mean, we shuttered the office in mid-March, meaning no one's going into the office. So all my editors are working remotely. And there was some kind of projects that were mid-completion when this whole thing went down. So we've kept some of our editors working through this process, but we've basically closed down the company and try to tighten our belts to get through it. That seems to me the best approach I can take. And luckily my landlord of my office space is not charging rent for April. So that's a huge relief for me.
That's awesome.
If I had to take that rent on, it would be basically a complete negative. There's not one shoot happening. I did do a shoot for Al Jazeera last week, but that was a real exception, and that was kind of done with a single person in the field. But there's just not a lot of production happening right now. I don't know when it's going to come back, but hopefully we'll survive it.
So do you think it'll be like a weird year for like just media coming out?
You know, I'm using the downtime to write a new movie. So I'm not even, though, I mean, I don't want it to go on forever, but I'm really enjoying that I finally get this time to focus on a new script that I'm writing every day and every night. So I've been taking advantage of the downtime and where I don't have to, this big company to worry about running.
Focus
on my writing, which is a blessing. So that's the upside of it for me.
Awesome. My final question is, what advice would you have for students at ND or anything you wish you knew when you were there on things they should look into, things they should think about?
But I went to Notre Dame to get a real broad liberal arts education, and I have no regrets about that. I mean, if you're going to write movies and direct movies, you want to have something to say, right? I always feel like one of my knocks on Quentin Tarantino is the guy only really knows other movies, and I don't feel like the guy is really that deep of a person. I think most of his idea of what reality is comes from inside movies, and I don't think he's lived a very interesting life. And I think it shows in his work. You know, I know a lot of people love Tarantino, but I really don't think there's a lot of actual real life wisdom in his films at all, because I don't think the guy has really done much soul searching. He's worked very hard to become a master of the craft and a master of the history of cinema. But I don't find there to be a lot of depth there. If you look at the ending of Hollywood, the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, mm-hmm. I think it's a horrible way to
I know, yeah. It was, I disliked it strongly. I was like, what is happening? Why am I so unpleased? Yeah.
It's just so many issues the guy has to work out, and he works them out in movies, and we have to look at it. And that's my point. I mean, Notre Dame is a great opportunity to get a well-rounded education, study philosophy, study psychology, study world religions. I definitely loved all the theology classes I got out of Notre Dame. Develop a view of and a perspective about life that you want to share with the world, especially if you can come up with a view or perspective that's unique for yourself. And I spent a lot of time in my 20s thinking about what is the nature of reality, and got into existentialism and all this kind of heavy stuff, which now is very relevant based on the plague that we're living through. Mm-hmm. But you know, that then I, when I worked out a lot of that stuff, I feel like that changed who I am, and that therefore gave me, as I was finding my voice as a filmmaker, I had something that was cultivated over years of like looking inward and thinking about what I want to say and what I believe. And having something to say is always going to make you a better artist and filmmaker than having just like Tarantino comments about other films and how I can rip off other films to make really cool stuff. You know, I think Scorsese, on the other hand, is someone that did spend, you know, he was in the seminary, Scorsese, and it was very deep, and his movies are much richer to me than Tarantino's. If you look at a movie like Raging Bull or Taxi Driver, there's so much more there, and they hold up so much better over time because of that. There's a worldview there, and there's a philosophy behind this filmmaking that comes across. Same with Kubrick and Fellini. These guys were all much deeper thinkers than a lot of the modern stuff that you see. That honestly, it's fine, it's entertainment, but it's like Scorsese said, these Marvel movies to me are just roller coaster rides. They're not really enriching anybody's life other than a bit of escapism for 2 hours.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks for asking me a lot.
Yeah.
Questions makes me think about my journey a little bit, so that's always good.
Richard, thank you for your time. I think this will be super helpful. I was going to share it with the class I'm in, so.
But well, yeah, let me know if I can do anything for you when you get out of school. You take interns and stuff like that. If you end up coming to New York, for sure. But either way, you can stay in touch.
Definitely. Thank you so much. You have a good day.
All right, you too.